I'm in Empire State South, my restaurant in Midtown Atlanta. I'm sitting with a rude friend of mine who is a very established baker. His name is Chris Wilkins, and he has Root Baking here in Atlanta, which used to be in Charleston. And, Chris, good to have you here.
Good to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Regale me with the wisdom of how the hell you became a baker. Because you're really, I mean, not that bakers aren't really super bright people, but you're a man of weird, crazy, odd knowledge.
Yeah.
And trivia.
Yeah. Well, that's
good. Chris is really good at trivia. So how did you become a baker?
Yeah. Well, you... Jeez.
You fell into it, didn't you?
Fell
into
it.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. I don't know what it means, but every baker does fall into it. Like, anytime you ask a baker how they became a... It's, like, specifically bread bakers, too. Like, pastry chefs have to, like, seek out being pastry chefs, and bread bakers always like, well, I was just kind of doing this thing, and then I floated into it, and then all of a sudden, here I am baking bread for a living. So basically what I was... Long story short, I was in graduate school in Indiana University, and I decided that, yeah.
Go Hoosiers.
Yeah. Hey, listen, don't...
Was that in the Bobby Knight era?
I was not there during Bob Knight's reign.
No chairs thrown at you.
Listen, if you want to have a discussion about Bob Knight, I'll have a discussion about Bobby
Knight.
We'll
get to Bob Knight. But we have a shared love of basketball.
Yeah, but I also... I'm troubled by my relationship with Bobby, so we'll get there, I guess.
Is it on the rocks?
Yeah.
Did you guys just fall into a relationship you fell into baking?
No. We have no relationship. I want to be on the record. I have no relationship with Bobby Knight. He is a huge Trump guy. I respect his basketball genius. Anyway, we're getting.
Yeah, no. He's a basketball genius. But back to baking. So you're in Bloomington, and Bloomington is the place where you first got into baking?
Yeah. Well, I grew up like kind of in the pizza industry. And I grew up kind of in the pizza industry a little bit, which sounds kind of crazy, but like
now explain that, because you mentioned that sort of weirdly before, like you're the member of a mafioso family.
Wait a minute,
I do have to stop this because Chris, how tall are you?
6'2", 6'3".
Not that Italian people are in any means on the shorter side of life; they seem to be very average. But Chris has bright red hair, which is not exactly what you think of as an Italian person.
Yeah,
but there you are.
Well, they look like everybody, of course. Yeah, well, it's on my mom's side. At any rate, so I guess my godfather was...
The godfather?
Yeah, the godfather.
Okay, your godfather is a pizzeria guy.
He was a pizza supply guy.
Pizza supply?
Yeah. So if you were like... I'm from upstate New York, western New York, the Finger Lakes.
Rochester?
I'm not from Rochester, no. But I'm from...
Buffalo?
No, I'm from a small town outside Rochester.
What's it called?
Penyan, New York.
Penyan?
Yeah, Penyan, New York, and Bath, New York are the places I lived. Any rate.
So the Godfather's in Pizzeria Supply.
Towns on Cuckoo Lake. And yeah, Pizza Supply, Southern Tier Provisions. And
so they sell food, or they just sell like pizza paddles and boxes?
You're giving me the most judgmental look right now.
I know, no, it's not. I'm just trying to get into this.
Okay, so
I don't know how the pizza business works.
So every time I've told this story, people think I am like some mobbed up person. I'm not. So here's the thing: if you had a pizzeria, don't look at me. Look at somewhere else.
So
if you had a pizzeria and you need sauce and cheese and you know whatever
they buy
else.
Sauce they
flour
don't make sauce.
Yeah, lots of pizzerias like buy sauce like buy tomatoes okay, and, or okay, tomatoes yeah, about, yeah. about that you know tomatoes or cheese you know from like Palio, which is like there's like a Palio factory near where I grew up. You would buy it from like you know it's like a like
you said of, Palio like it's like actually Palio, kind Palio of Italian cheese. But that's like the Polly dash O.
it's
like the most Americanized Italian cheese ever.
Well, there's like a factory Palio. Well, sorry, everyone says
you were like Palio. Palio.
I did say that.
You did. I will rewind this.
Cool.
Later.
All right. So here's what this is the longest story ever. So here's what happens. If you need like if you buy tomatoes in Atlanta, you call like a distributor, right? So you call a supplier, right? Right. Okay. So imagine that, but for pizza, and that's what I got. Anyway, like the first job I ever had was like washing, like the big rig trucks, you know?
Yep.
For my godfather and like helping out in the deli and stuff like that. So anyway, I kind of grew up around that part of the food, which is not food. Like I never really worked in restaurants. I didn't really care for restaurants that much, and so I liked the like that was my favorite job ever. Like it just like it felt like a clubhouse. It felt kind of I was like 13, 14, 15 years old, right?
But that's not bread. I mean, that's dope.
No, no, it's not bread at all. That's just not bread at all. But it was like you were just in this world of like I don't know. I liked that part of the food world, so I was like drawn to pizzerias and like, you know, anyway, yada yada, fast forward a million years or whatever, and so now I'm in Indiana and I didn't want to become an academic. I thought that was a pretty boring way to live a life, and so yeah, I decided, well, my now wife was in pharmacy school in Vermont, and I was in Indiana, and I needed to buy airfare. So I got a job at a bakery while I was just going to school to buy plane tickets, and I, you know, I liked it a lot, and so applied for a job out in Vermont when I left graduate school, and got a job in this great bakery.
So what was the bakery in Bloomington?
It's not there anymore. It was called, Sweet Claire's, I think, something like that.
Sweet Claire's.
Oh, no, just one sweet. You can call it Sweet Claire's.
I'm just adding
Claire's.
Sweets on. I mean, it's sweet Claire's. Sweet. That's another business.
Yeah,
I think
you said it sort of just creepily, which is cool.
Paulio.
Which is fine.
Paulio.
But anyway, I got this job in a bakery in Vermont, which is like a I didn't know this at the time.
At University of Vermont Montpelier.
Nikki?
Yeah.
No, she was at pharmacy school in
what city?
Burlington. It was in Burlington,
Vermont.
Yeah. And so she was there. And so I got a job in this really great bakery. But I didn't know it was a great I thought the bread was beautiful. And little did I know that my boss there was like, you know the Christmas Carol? You know, where he goes, like, works for Fezziwigs? It's like this great boss who like takes care of his people and throws like the best Christmas parties. That's what it sort of felt like at that bakery. Like, I learned a ton. It was like finishing school for like learning how to be a baker. So
is there a Scrooge baker like to counter that?
Yeah, definitely. I worked for him. Okay. I worked for him for sure.
This guy is the most amazing baker.
Yeah. Like Barack Obama, like invited him to the White House because he was that good of a business owner. Like seriously, this is like, he's an incredible baker. And he's like a pioneer in local grain, the use of local grains and whole grains and all this kind of stuff.
And a lot of so they were gristing their own.
They were not milling, no, but they were buying a lot of local flour,
okay.
And which was like, and when they started 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and it was like unheard of at the time.
So you worked there.
Yeah.
Then what was the next step?
I worked for a guy named Gerard Roubaud, which is, he's like legendary.
Is he the Scrooge?
He's definitely the Scrooge, yeah. He passed away a few months back, but maybe
we can talk bad about him now.
Well.
Too early?
It might be. I don't know. Someday. Oh, geez. There's definitely a book about Gerard. Any baker listening to this, any bread baker, serious bread baker listening to this, definitely knows of him. He's a notorious, and if you're in the Northeast, you definitely heard of him. He's a notorious sort of, a notorious sort of grump and an incredible baker. Like,
yeah,
I was there when Sever.
I was just
about
to say that we often learn from the demons of the world some good technique. But
it was,
boy.
No, I learned a lot from him, a ton. And we had some of the greatest conversations I've ever had with a human being, with that guy. But he had these two dogs who would, like, howl. We only listened to, like, free French radio out of Montreal. And so his dogs, they play the Canadian National Anthem every day at 5 a.m. And so his dogs would start howling at the anthem, and then they stop when it stopped. And so if you walked in late, because if you walked in after the howling stopped, he would scream.
You were late?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's quite a way of getting welcomed to the French Canadian National Anthem and these two
howling
dogs.
Labradors, yeah. And then they would, like, harass the llamas, so we'd get all these phone calls from, like, the...
Harass the llamas.
There's a llama farm, like, by the bakery. It was, like, a farm. He had, like, this little baker and a farm that he owned. And, like, the guy from, like, Fish had a house, like, across the mountain from him. Like, it was, like, really nice. And so, like,
guy from Fish? The main dude, whatever his name is?
Dude, I don't know anything about that world.
That's Fish, P-H-I-S-H. Look them up if you're into jam bands.
Yeah. So, I don't know anything about that stuff. But basically, we had, like, a llama farm. There's a llama farm, like, you know.
So you say llama farm, automatically, I'm thinking Vermont.
Yeah, that's where it was. It was in Vermont.
Seems like, for sure.
It's beautiful, right?
Outside Burlington.
And he had this dog that would go harass the llamas, and so Gerard was convinced they would call the town would like call Gerard and be like, you know, get your dog out of here. And he'd be like, I can't help it if my dog has a lover on the llama farm. And he just would do stuff like that, right? He would just like...
Was the dog in love with another llama or a dog at the llama farm?
Gerard made it sound to me as if Max the dog was in love with a llama. Yes. You've heard me correctly. Yeah.
So you think that's possible?
I'm not in the business of telling who to love.
Not biologically.
I think you love who you love. You know what I mean? And it's Vermont. Vermont is a very accepting state, and I think that's great. You know, so if you're Max the dog, live your life.
It's very independent that way.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but Gerard taught you a lot about bread. What's the biggest takeaway from working with somebody like Gerard?
Respect for the craft. Absolutely. Respect for the craft, right?
It is a craft. It's such
And also like a precision. Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, but a precision that is like, he gave me two of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard, frankly, and I hated him. When I worked for him, I hated him. But one piece of advice he gave me was that, you know, he made 144 loaves every day except Sunday, right? By himself. So it's just me and him. And I remember he told me, like, I had messed up a few loaves or something, and as I was wont to do, because I didn't, you know, I kind of knew what I was doing, but not really when I took that job. And he screamed at me and whatever. And he told me, it's like, this is, I make 144 loaves. Like, you can only mess up one. Like, that is your, like, basically cull rate is what he would call it. Or, you know, that's the margin for error for us. Like, I need to sell that. That could be the difference between me. That $8 I get from that loaf of bread is the difference between our profit and our, you know, our loss or whatever.
Breaking even.
Yeah, right. And so I, having like the, he, every loaf had to be perfect, right? And of course they're not all going to be, but like that, the mindset that like, if I'm going to do this, I might as well get them all right. And the smaller I do it, the more I have to get right, because I need to get, I need to focus, right? So he had like an intensity and a focus that was, in my opinion,
so
sort of unmatched.
What's that first piece of advice then? That it all matters?
Like, it all matters.
Everyone matters?
Every loaf matters, and we have to, like, your all of your attention. The reason he told me, like, the reason he bakes in the middle of an apple orchard in Vermont is that, like, to focus on the bread, because he was obsessed. He ate the same meal every day. He slept like a few times, like Kramer, when Kramer did it from Seinfeld, like he thought like Da Vinci slept like 5 minutes for every hour. So Gerard actually did that though. So he would get like these little cat naps in the bakery. And this is true. And he's obsessed with baking. He's obsessed with bread, right? And
so it was his second piece of advice.
The second piece of advice he gave me was that you should always take a job that feels a little bit above you and rise to it.
That's great advice.
It's great advice. Yeah, it was. I did not like this man, and I felt way over my head. No, I learned a ton.
It sounds like he wasn't nice, but he probably wasn't a demagogue. But yeah, maybe he was a bit of one. Who knows? Okay, so you go from Vermont.
I met Tom Leonard. So I quit Gerard because he didn't pay me, to be honest with you. And so I crawled back to my old. My Fezziwig boss, Randy George is his name. I should say that out loud because he's an incredible human being and a friend now. I'm like, Randy, can I have a job, please? I'm desperate. I'll do anything. He gives me my old job back. And, you know, and then he asked me, he's like, have you heard of this fellow named Tom Leonard? He's opening a bakery in Athens, Georgia. And I know you're not going to stay in Vermont forever. So anyway, I met Tom Leonard, and Tom Leonard asked me if I wanted to help open a bakery in Athens, which became...
Tom is an amazing human who owns a bakery that Chris helped opened up, and Chris is actually still a part owner of that.
Yeah, a little bit. Yep.
Independent Baking in Athens, Georgia, which was a game changer in Athens because really bread production was... There was no good bakery in Athens before Independent, and Independent's done a really amazing job. But Tom's legacy in the world
Tom's
of
a legend.
Baking
yeah, he's
is,
a legend.
Touch on that a
he's,
little bit.
He's a legend. I mean, there's bread is like its own little niche of a niche. Food is a niche, right? And bread is a niche inside that. And then like the kind of baking that we do at Root or that Tom does is like whole grain, natural leavening, local fresh milled. That's like an even smaller niche. And so like there's only a few folks, we all know each other, but Tom in the wider baking circles is very well known and respected for being the guy. He's like, he's done, his life is incredible. He's done a million different things, but also he is the guy that helped put whole grain baking and natural leavening in the minds of what the current generation of American bakers who do this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it is so funny that we kind of do take it for granted now that we take it for granted that our bread is made out of good flour. And that is not really usually the case. Just talk about, and Chris at Root Baking and Tom at Independent Baking both have milling operations within, Tom's is somewhat separate from the bakery, but still a big mill. Mm-hmm. And then you have a very specific type of mill within Root where you're, what are you doing with that mill? You're milling all your own flour.
Yeah. We don't mill all our own flour. So we mill a lot of our own flour. But if we milled all our own flour, I wouldn't be able to make enough bread to frankly pay the rent. So, cause it just takes so long. So Tom and I have the same mill. It's made by a fella up in Vermont, named Andrew, at a place called, Elmore Mountain Baking. Andrew Hain is his name. He makes these beautiful mills. They're built for bakers, essentially. It's a stone mill with granite that comes from, Barrie, Vermont. And he builds these mills himself, and they're gorgeous, and they are incredibly effective. And
they are beautiful pieces of machinery.
They look like modern art a little bit.
They are like modern wood art, and then the stones inside.
To get into your question.
What was my question?
What are we doing with the mill?
Are you doing with the mill?
Right. So I guess what we're doing with the mill then is so my thesis on baking is that flour doesn't really taste like anything unless it's fermented. You know? So if you took your finger into a bag of flour and rubbed it in your gums like a cop in like an 80s movie or something, you wouldn't taste anything except like kind of sawdust. You know? And so there's no flavor there really. You know, and so I think my thesis is that the way to unlock the flavor of any kind of grain is to ferment it, right? To make those sugars
so
available.
So you're fermenting before milling.
We're fermenting after we mill,
just the fermentation process of like natural leavening.
Yeah, exactly. Starters. Yeah, but the other half of that is that I think that it is my belief that like each grain, each varietal of grain, they all taste a little bit different when fermented, right? Like spelt tastes different than Rouge de Bordeaux. Rouge de Bordeaux tastes a little bit different than, it's a lot different than rye, of course. But like the way we unlock these flavors is to ferment those freshly milled things, ferment those flours at the peak, at the height of flavor, right? Which is just off the mill, in my opinion. And so that's why we do it. We mill all of our starters are freshly milled.
Wonder Bread, not so much.
No.
So what's AP flour?
AP flour is all-purpose flour.
I know that, but I mean, white AP flour.
Well, yeah.
In my basic understanding is it's stripped of all the, it's like the integral center part of the grain,
mm-hmm.
and that's it, right? Everything else is stripped away, all the bran.
And the endosperm, right. Endosperm. So, yeah, yes and no. It AP flour sort of gets a bad rap, you know what I mean? I think the thing I'm always wary of doing is sort of evangelizing for just like there's this movement in bakeries where there's this really people who are just really hardcore about 100% whole grains, and I think that has a place, but I also think that like a good baguette is AP flour, something close to AP flour, maybe a little more speckling in it from the brand.
Yep.
Yeast and water and salt, like there's not much more to it, and that a great baguette is a pretty magical thing in my opinion.
So where does the great baguette come from? Is it the skill and technique? It's all technique.
I mean,
the thing about, when we talk about food, you can, there are a lot of chefs who have the ability and maybe necessarily don't have technique to be able to cook something amazingly well and rely on gussying things up with ingredients and layers of lavishness to things. But bread is just
three ingredients.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Yeah.
That's it.
There's nowhere to hide. Yeah. Bakers, I find the reason I like baking as much as I do is that we tend to be very straightforward in almost everything, right? So when we give criticisms, they tend to be blunt and without any kind of emotion either way. Like we pull bread out, it's either good or bad. And it's like, there really is no in between. You know, for us, it's like, that's terrible, but we'll try it again tomorrow. Right. And that's behind every criticism that we have of our own work and our team's work and everything else. And so we tend to be very blunt in our critiques of bread and baked goods in general, because like this is what it is. Right. And there's another day and we'll try again tomorrow.
But the breadth of a bakery, I guess depends. We don't really equate the South with a lot of great baking prowess. I mean, not bread. Mm-hmm. We do in pies and cakes and things like that, but bread, I think, was never the forte of the South. But when we think of like the Northeast and where I'm from, Montreal and Ottawa and Toronto, all those areas, has a deep background in bread production. Yeah. But it's really interesting to me that the business model of the bakery in the South is the very contemporary model. That's what's going to work. So you make X number of different types of bread. You wholesale bread. Mm-hmm. You also do a pretty full pastry case.
Yep.
So what are you selling in the pastry case? You're doing Krista's amazing laminate croissants and things like that are outlandishly good.
Yeah, sort of vinoiserie is called. Anything that would fall traditionally, anything proofed that falls like in the pastry-wise typically falls in the realm of a bread baker, right? Yeah. Other really fancy stuff, like I make really bad cakes. I'm not good at it.
Don't go to rebaking for cake.
No, we won't make a cake. We'll just say no and recommend you to one of our friends who does a great job with cake, right? Because it's just not really what we're good at, and I would rather
refuse to make somebody's wedding cake. Is that what you're saying?
I have in the past and will in the future, because I don't want to ruin your wedding.
That's
you know,
go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, someone will.
Like, no, my defense is I don't make good cakes.
I don't want to ruin your special day. I mean, I could, but you'd have a better cake at Publix, I'm sure.
Okay, so back to the.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, we're good. So you're in Athens. You open up Root with Tom.
Independent.
You open up Independent with Tom. After that,
I met you.
Yeah, you met me.
I met you.
Chris was Chris mastered all the dough and bread baking and all the dessert program and everything at a restaurant that I had for a while called the Florence, which is in Savannah, Georgia. It was short lived because it was on probably the wrong side of a street. I don't know. We never know those reasons for failure.
Arguably.
And then you and your dear wife, Nikki, moved to
Charleston
and opened up a really interesting concept, because this is Root Baking in its first iteration.
Yep.
And explain that was, because it wasn't a Luxo looking bakery.
No, I remember you visited.
I visited.
Yeah, that's right. So, we opened the bakery. Yeah. I mean, it was completely bootstrapped in a way that was crazy. So people have told me in recently now that like how crazy it was when I presented them with the business model the first time, but basically we rented this old fireworks stand, which was next to a sign contractor on one side and like a stonemason on the other. And it was like,
by the way, it was out on the coastal highway.
It was
15 minutes from really the middle of Charleston.
Yeah. And it was,
it was south of there.
Yep.
On Highway 17.
Yep. It was great. But it was also,
but it had no retail really front
no,
space.
None at all. And it had no, it was just a workshop. So
it's
basically
like a shotgun shaped workshop.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so I'll never forget the landlord. He's a great guy. It's one of the best landlords I've ever had. He told me, he's like, listen, your rent will be nothing, but you have to do it. Man, good luck with this thing. If you can get up to this, if you can get this like rezoned, we had to get it rezoned. We had to like plant trees to get it rezoned, this whole thing. And so we did it and, you know, got a bank loan for not very much money, to be honest with you, because we kind of bootstrapped the whole thing and did a lot of work ourselves and friends helped us and stuff. And so, you know, and then that's kind of how it happened. And we started I started bringing the bread. I thought, honestly, it sounds really stupid to say this in public, but honestly, I thought like, well, I think people will buy this bread if I just show up.
If you bake it, they
will come. Yeah, which in retrospect is so stupid.
I don't think it's stupid.
Well,
see, Chris makes like amazing bread.
If I was a banker and I met me, looking back, I'd be like, no, man.
But to me, it's really interesting because you went to a town that you didn't really know.
No, I didn't. I knew nobody. I knew nobody there. I had no connection to
but
Charleston.
But suddenly you cracked into a lot of selling wholesale.
Yeah.
And that was real. I mean, it was 95% wholesale there.
It was wholesale and farmers markets.
Weirdos. Really dedicated bread buyer
who would show up at the workshop.
Out.
Yeah. Yeah. We had quite a bit.
No retail front. So they came into
the workshop. Like we had a lot. We had like regulars who came multiple times a week to get bread. Like we had one guy who like played Duke basketball, like, but in like the 1950s. He's a great guy.
Christian Leitner?
No, not Christian Leitner. A guy named Joe. He's a great guy. His son-in-law is
pro Leitner?
I don't. I'm from the Northeast, so Duke basketball.
Everybody has an opinion
on Christian Leitner. I'm not a big Duke basketball guy. Yeah,
I'm just going
good player.
Yeah, it's the program. Okay, we're gonna get into basketball.
We'll get there.
Yeah,
but we had people that came by. But basically, the concept was honestly, it's a little bit corny to say this out loud, but you know, I really thought like you know, I will bake bread. This is a very low rent. This is just, you know, a wholesale workshop, and I will take it to the community, and they will support me, maybe.
But they did. I don't think that was a silly idea. But, I mean, to give you a proper visualization, you know, two-lane highway at this point, going from sort of island to island, swampy land outside of Charleston, and Chris's Bakery, you could have missed it. I mean, it used to be a fireworks stand, but it could have been a bait shack. Whatever. It's not like there wasn't parking per se.
No.
I mean, there was space.
We had to gravel down or something. Yeah, we put some slag rock. I put it down myself. We had to install the concrete wheel stops for parking spaces.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we had to put those in.
Did you have to have a handicap spot?
Yes, I did. Yeah, even though it's just the rigmarole
of small businesses.
Yeah, which is okay. I mean, those are good lessons. Like, those are great lessons to learn. I mean,
I think the most enjoyable businesses I've ever opened are just the extraordinarily basic. We got to get this done. Punk rock it and open.
You just figure it out, which is what anybody throughout time has always ever done, right? So you just figure it out.
I know, but not anymore. Now we're
or you don't
open up very convoluted. Crazy expensive stuff.
No, I know.
Takes way too much time and effort.
But it's okay. But that's okay too. But I think like you know, there's a way in which like I learned how to fix my own equipment. Right. I learned how bakeries work, which is like there's more to bakeries than just making good bread. And like I don't think I have any advice for anybody, frankly. But if I did, it would be that making good bread is a terrible reason to open a bakery. Right. Like you know, just because you make good bread is. Terrible reason to start a bakery.
Well, it's a terrible reason to start a restaurant if you like cooking.
Right, I agree. Like, I was seeking out like this sort of like deep understanding of how to build a relationship with a community through food, and also how to like frankly build a business. I had never really built a business before.
And I think you're selling mostly at that point in Root and Charleston. You're selling 98%, let's say, to restaurants.
Yep.
Wholesaling.
Yep. We got some great restaurant accounts. Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing dining city. But that's also another layer of being a baker is suddenly you're delivering, you're carrying credit accounts for people. Some of them pay on time.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them don't pay.
Yeah,
like they just, you know, think the bread just appears on trees.
Yes.
You're suddenly opening up the Pandora's box of anxiety in small business.
Sure.
So how do you get through that? And then you're also setting up a farmer's markets?
Farmer's markets, yeah. Yeah, because that's frankly the way to make
money.
Was
that once a week?
It was twice a week. We went to two different farmer's markets. Because basically my model was that of a farmer. All my friends in Charleston, frankly, were farmers. And a few, I didn't really hang out with that many chefs, to be completely honest with you. We didn't have much to talk about. I hung out with growers, and so like
chefs don't have much to talk about.
No, I didn't have much to talk about with a lot of chefs. Like I can't relate to like the stresses of service or like you know the kitchen culture. Really, that's not really my world, and not really the world
culture.
I'm interested in. Yeah, I was more interested in like what you're growing and how you're you know what you're planting as cover crop or whatever. You know what I mean? And so like frankly, I know the bakery sounds like it was in a crazy location, but it was like right down the road from Clemson Ag Extension, right, which is where Brian Ward, the guy who does all the growing trials for Anson Mills, he's there. He's one of the most incredible farmers I've ever met.
To fill in and define some stuff, Anson Mills is an amazing project started years ago by Glenn Roberts. Glenn Roberts is a Southern historian of grain and a brilliant, brilliant man. He doesn't really farm himself all that much, but
he knows a lot about farming, though.
He knows a ton about farming, but really started sort of a cooperative system of getting grains like Carolina Gold rice and really good strains of corn for grits and flint corns back into the realm of food culture in the South.
Yeah. It was a crazy place for a baker, and also really wasn't, because I was right down the road from farmers, people with PhDs who farmed, right? And so the kind of baking I do is that kind of baking, right? I was talking directly to farmers. And so it seemed crazy, but the way I saw it at the time, and I think still see it this way, is that I thought Charleston was one of the best food cities in the Southeast, right? And so I said, like, if I think I want to make great bread, I want to make it for chefs who are really interested in like using an ingredient that maybe a lot of chefs would just see it as a commodity, right? I knocked on Sean Brock's door and Mike Lauda's door and all these guys whose work I respected and who I thought would maybe see this for what I saw it as, right? Which was something special, right? Using Southern ingredients, using the flavors of the South that I'm not from, but I love, frankly, and would do something with it that was interesting and would get the community interested, because Charleston is a very chef-driven town in a lot of ways. And so I thought, well, if I can get my rye bread, someone to put some pickled shrimp on my rye bread, I might could make it, you know.
You did pretty well with that.
I did.
Where was that dish?
Edmund's Oast. It paid my rent for like 6 months. They're my only account. And when I got them,
it's a busy restaurant. They buy a lot of bread.
They bought a lot of rye bread for pickled shrimp, and it was great. That was like the breakthrough, right? And so like, and that's how it happens. Like you meet. And to answer your earlier question about like how do you handle like wholesaling to restaurants, which are tough to get paid by, you know, of course. I tried to only work with chefs who I thought I could hang out with, and so wouldn't, you know, stiff me,
right?
You know, because they would respect our work enough that
feel guilty.
Yeah, I can't.
When it was your turn to buy them a beer and they hadn't paid you for 3 months.
And also, you know what? Like a lot of the restaurant accounts we had, like, didn't buy that much, right? Or the deliveries would be pretty small, so I'd be delivering like $35. You know what I mean? So, like, I know you have $35 around here, man. Like, come on. and so that's how I sort of balanced it, I guess. Was like I tried to do business with people who I respected and who I liked and who I thought were professionals.
So after a number of years in Charleston, you decided to move the bakery. You sold the existing one.
I did.
Somebody else took it over and opened up in another name,
yep,
which is cool because you retained the name Root Baking Company.
Yes.
And opened up in Ponce City Market.
Yep.
In a big space. So in this, I just want to talk about how that move went, how the Atlanta market is much bigger and different in ways, and then how developers work, because I think that's interesting. In talking about that, and
it is really interesting.
It's just interesting to me and how popular. So Ponce City Hall, for those who don't know what it is I think it's the second largest brick building in North America. And it used to be called City Hall East, and at one point in time it was the Sears or Macy's.
Sears Roebuck.
Massive building on Ponce de Leon Avenue in Atlanta that was purchased a number of years ago by Jamestown Properties, a group out of Cologne, Germany, but has a lot of U.S. holdings. And they really turned it into this mixed use, that classic food hall of the modern 2000s, that type of thing. And
I guess they were one of the first, though, which is interesting, is what they sort of, I mean, there's been a lot of folks like Ponce now, I think, but I think Ponce was...
Chelsea Market was
Chelsea, right,
York,
right, yeah. So it's the Southern, I think it's sort of, I guess, the Southern equivalent of what Chelsea Market is to New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's...
Well...
So you moved there.
Well,
what's the impetus for moving?
Well, I should be clear that, like, they asked us. Like, I didn't seek out this food mall. You know what I mean? I was pretty happy in Charleston that we had like reached a level of like sustainability. That was like you kind of
economic viability.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So like, I was getting days off. I had staff, like Nicole and I had taken a vacation, which is like, it was, so we were like kind of humming. Right. And, they kind of knocked on our door, and asked us what we thought about this kind of thing. And first, our first answer was like, no, you know, cause I don't really know Atlanta that well. And, but clearly I have a history of like going into cities where I don't know anybody. And so, and just trying to make friends, and which is what we did in Charleston. So I was like, well, we built this great support network in Charleston of people who are, frankly, some of the best in their field, right? It's like we have Glenn Roberts and Greg Johnsman and these, all these people who know a lot and who I learned a lot from, who really became really close friends and family of ours. It's like this was our little Southern family that Nicole and I built. And so when they knocked on our door, and I mean, listen, Charleston's a wonderful town, and I it's like home to me in a lot of ways, but it's also like got serious infrastructural problems. I had a 750 square foot brick building, cinder block building, and like the bakery floods, you know, like, and flooding in Charleston is a real problem. And so I was standing the year before we moved, I was standing in front of the bakery, and I had water up to right below my knee. And I was just like, I'm not sure I can do this again because this is tough. Like, this is really tough. I'm not sure if I was, you know, I'm not capitalized enough to do the kind of improvements to the building that I needed, because we really bootstrapped this thing.
So you were like, where's that cold collar developer?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, I had a relationship with the developer a little bit, because you know, like any business, it's a collection of individuals. Right. And so I had a friend who kind of helped me see the value of a place like a food hall, right? Which is, because I said, like, I don't want to be, I said something, you know, sort of petulant, like, I don't want to be in your, you know, mall or something, which I'm sure made them really mad.
I don't want to be in your palace of gentrification.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then I went on, and then I went on tour with Fugazi.
And you're like, cool, sold.
well, then I'll never forget what he told me. He's like, well, listen, like, there's a community here. Like, you gotta look at it, but you gotta squint a little bit, but there's a community here. And so then I took a few trips up here, and yeah, I saw it. Like, you see regulars.
And
you
it's here.
They are here.
Like, yeah, it is. And it's meant a lot to the city. It's a really interesting array of different restaurants and places like that. But what you entered into is very, I mean, juxtaposed to the old bakery in Charleston. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a brand spanking new looking, very built out, very pretty, very retail oriented looking bakery.
Yep.
That's got more food service and stuff like that. Yep. Right. You know, and, but still is facilitating a lot of wholesale. So it's always interesting to me because this is a, developers these days will entice us to go into these places, and often the rent's going to be higher in the end result, but they usually will take care of a lot of the build out.
Yes.
And really come up to the table with money that we just do not have.
And well, frankly, nobody has, right?
And nobody has. Nobody, but they want to fill their spaces, and I mean, they'll basically, tenant improvement or TI money is kind of like a very long-term loan based on your lease.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't quite figured out whether it's a good thing or a bad thing yet.
Well, I wrestle with that too, but I think that there's this way in which, like, so I never had the money. Like, I couldn't have opened up a bakery in downtown Charleston. I couldn't. I no way. You know what I mean? Nicole and I are not that well capitalized. We're just like two young people with a bank loan. You know what I mean? And my bank's not gonna look at us and be like, yeah, cool, here's, you know, 400 grand or something, whatever it costs to do that, right? And so, like, what we saw here was like a city that we really liked. Like, I don't mean to downplay this as some kind of like purely economic move. We came up here and we're like, this is where we should be. Like, this is great. Like, we feel very comfortable here and can see ourselves living here, and we can always go back to Charleston. We need to see our friends, and so that's why we did it, frankly. So that's how these decisions work, of course. And so, but as far as like where we are now, I mean, like, we get a lot of people who say, like, what a weird place for a bakery, because we're next to like a sewing studio thing, and like there's a food mall downstairs, you know what I mean? And so there's like,
yeah,
a,
it's up on the second level. My, so downstairs, a neighbor, separation
is a, my downstairs neighbor is a Williams Sonoma, right? And so, like, people tell me all the time what a weird place this is for a bakery, and I'm like, well, you think this is weird? Like, I had a bakery next to a sign contractor.
So
that's
highway,
a weird place for a bakery.
Fireworks store.
Yeah, like that's a weird place for a bakery. Like so weird that it wasn't even zoned for one. And so like, I think that, yeah. Listen, I'm not sure where. I think if you put something, I think if you put your vision into the world and a vision that you share with talented people, and you folks can rally around that. I think that people will find it no matter where you are. And that's the lesson I learned from Charleston. It's like, we were in the middle of nowhere and people came out and found us. Right. And people will find you if you try and resonate.
If you make a spectacular product and
people
are just magnetically able to find stuff that matters.
And I think so. And that's where I come down on. Right. And every time I get down a little bit about like, oh man, like, oh, geez, like this is just, My neighbors, I love William Sonoma. I'm sure they're great people, William Sonoma. But I'm like, this is just this huge retail store downstairs, and I'm like, we are not that way.
No,
and so like,
I mean,
and every time I get down about that, I'm like, you know what though? Like we have I know lots of people that come in here multiple times a week, and that matters. Like the retail politics matters in this industry, in my opinion.
But it is really bakeries and restaurants are really small margin. I think William Sonoma has a little bit more clout than we do.
Yeah, they're doing well.
Yeah, but you know,
I think, I don't know. You heard about what's that place in New York that
Dina DeLuca.
Yeah, yeah.
The demise of Dina DeLuca.
I thought that place would never go out of business.
I know, but how much truffle oil you have to sell? That's a lot.
They left a bakery. They owed a bakery like $35,000.
How do you owe a bakery $35,000?
That's a great question.
That's a lot of
I'm
bread.
Chasing you down for $400. I'm chasing you down for $50.
Yeah. I was reading the New York Times about a chef who passed away way too early. Named Elka, and she was a woman chef in San Francisco. It's really way ahead of her time, but she was in her mid-50s when she passed away, and just recently. But so there's one quote in this obituary. It was a really great, beautifully written obituary, but it talked about nobody really understands the anxiety and stress of the restaurant business until you have to sell your car to make payroll as a business owner.
Yeah.
And I kind of... But it's strange within the confines of some of these mixed-use developments and food halls that you have these massive brick-and-mortar chain-type places, and then you have these little mom-and-pops interspaced in there, too, who, like, barely get by.
Yeah.
And, you know, once in a while, things like selling your car to make payroll really are true.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, too, because that sort of resonates on a different level with me, because I had to sell my bicycle. I got ripped off by a contractor in Charleston. Guy took like, I don't know, $800 or whatever and just didn't do the work. And so we came up like $800 short in our build out. And that was like exactly what we kind of needed for our first flour order, right? Like a pallet of flour is what we needed to start. And so I sold my bicycle. It's like really, I used to ride fairly seriously, I guess. And so like, it was a really nice bicycle that I was really proud of. And I was like, I need flour. Like you have bakery
that fable
needs flour.
Cutting the hair.
Exactly.
Same
and so,
type of thing. Well,
that's what I think that like. But then, and every time, I am also of the firm belief that as business owners, like, you know, we rely on each other because we're all in the same, I mean, pretty terrible low margin ship, but also. We all know and have this shared understanding how great it can be and how great it is fundamentally. You wouldn't do it again unless we're a bunch of like maladjusted addicts or something.
I mean,
which could be true too.
You know what I say all the time. I'm like, maybe I'll just become a dental hygienist.
Yeah.
And dental hygiene is my code for saying I sometimes just want a job that's 9 to 5 that I just don't have to worry about.
Sure.
And
I also think that like, do you?
But
right?
I would die
do you
on
really?
The inside
of course you
if
would.
I didn't do it.
Of course
do.
You would. Right. And that's what I mean. And so like we have asked for every problem that we have. Right. And that's where.
I know. But the anxiety, Chris.
I know. It's the worst. But it's also, I don't know. There is, and we can talk about it, I guess. But like there is a way in which. This business is deeply misunderstood by like the public. I think probably, you know, it is romanticized in a way that like the economic realities of the business and the coverage of this business don't quite resonate as well.
What do you charge for a croissant?
$3.25.
Do people complain about that?
No, I think it's a fair price.
so nobody complains. I'm not asking you think it's overpriced.
No, every once in a while we get complaints about our pricing on laminated pastries and stuff. Every now and then, but it's, listen, man, you don't need a croissant. Like we
your croissants have like a pound of butter in each of them. not that much,
not quite. But yeah, I know what you mean. But like, yeah, so we don't charge. Our bread is quite reasonable, and it's organic, and it's all that kind of yada yada stuff. But like, and so we keep our price of bread down, kind of on purpose. We make a little less margin on the bread for a reason that I believe that bread is a staple. It's not dessert. You can't. I don't think. My personal belief is that the guy that hung the drywall in the bakery should be able to buy a loaf of bread, right? I believe that. And so it needs to be somewhat accessible to like folks who work, you know, working Carhartts for a living. And so like the price of pastries though is like, it has to reflect the cost of ingredients a little bit more because like, you know, butter is expensive and dairy farmers work really hard. And so all farmers work.
Is not a staple,
right? You don't need a cinnamon roll, but it's a treat. And sometimes it's good for you wholesomely and all that kind of thing. But
Pop-Tarts are staples.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or I tell myself that.
Yeah. You have a box of Pop-Tarts right now.
No, I don't. <I'm just kidding>. Pretend. I have some Paulio cheese. Paulio. but it's going well. I mean, you got nominated on the long list for a James Beard Award this year.
Sure.
Which is, to me, a recognition that you firmly deserve and I don't think you really care about, which is beautiful at the same time.
Well, it's because, it's like I said earlier, it's like we're bread bakers are, like, I'm also sort of like, I'm kind of like media allergic. I'm not online in a way that's like at all accessible. And so, but also,
you're not Brad Daddy 547.
Oh, that is me. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, just kidding. That's not me.
Brad Daddy.
I think there's someone on.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There is.
Oh, that's, don't Google that.
Don't search Brad Daddy.
That's going to be a super weird Google search. But I think that there's like a way in which, you know, so, I mean, I think I'm proud of the bread we make and all the food we make, frankly. But, you know, bread bakers are not, we're not used to being in the same kind of conversations as chefs, like chefdom or chef culture or kitchen culture. It's not our own. You know, it's weird. Our rhythms are different. We're just different folks, you know. And so the same kind of media or recognitions that chefs tend to value a little bit more, bakers aren't quite as interested in. Because, like, I mean, this is one of the oldest professions there is.
They're also generally up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, like
waking up to the French Canadian national anthem,
right.
Llamas and
this is
just
dogs. Yeah, and this is just like this is
crowing.
Just not the kind of job where you expect to like every bread you've done has been done better by somebody that existed hundreds of years before you. And so in baking that's a very apparent thing because it's like an everyday thing. It's like being a farmer, a dairy farmer. You're getting up every day to milk cows and stuff.
It's funny when you talk about bread. I mean, because it's so simple. I mean, foods, I don't know, has food advanced and gotten better? I think overall it has, I guess. There's definitely been a revolution in the way we look at food and how we cook it as chefs. But bread's kind of, it's still the quest just to make the best bread.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But that hasn't changed in like 2,000 years.
Exactly. And the only thing that's changed, I think, in baking particularly, there's you know, there's not much new under the sun, right? The reason we feel a little bit closer to farms is it feels a little bit more like a trade, because it's sort of a commodity that people take for granted, like cabinets are and tables, right? And every once in a while, someone will really admire a well-built table or a well-built, you know, chair or something. But like, and every once in a while, someone will admire a really beautifully crafted loaf of bread. But generally speaking, I understand that this is going to be sliced up and made for a salami sandwich or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or whatever it's going to be. And so, like, with that in mind, I still want whomever's having that sandwich to have the best possible bread for that sandwich.
Well, that's an interesting equation to product lines overall. Like, woodworking, I mean, there's particle board cabinets, which are definitely going to be 95% of what's out there. And then there's a person who hand carves everything in a small workshop.
Sure.
And I much more equate what you do to that side of the
spectrum. Yeah, and we right, because the particle board stuff is mass produced and stuff.
That you brought up that you still think the brand is necessarily a staple, and yeah. you want the drywall installer to be able to afford that too. So there's something.
Yeah, well, it has to be because like Tom Leonard likes to say, like, bread is not dessert, and to charge for a loaf of bread what you would for panna cotta is not, in my opinion, you know, not how I want to do things. And so, like, I think that we as bakers kind of have a very, in some level, have a deep understanding of how folks use this stuff. It's going to be a piece of toast, you know,
yeah.
It's going to be like, so, and will that, will, yeah, listen.
Which in so many different ways, it's going to be toast.
Yeah.
Is, could be bad thing.
Right, right.
Like your toast.
It's good toast. It's really good toast. Right.
Or but, there's also a toast to someone. That's a really multi-defined word.
Yeah.
Well, is that multi-defined? What's that word? Has many meanings.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know either. But I'm going to go make some toast. I like toast.
Well, I think that, like, because we have that understanding, there's a certain amount of, like, recognition's great. And, you know, I'm glad people think we're doing a nice job. But, like, you know,
you're not in it to win the baking Olympiad.
Well, there's no winning at this, and there's no winning at business, right? Like, there's just
it's just the ongoing day.
It's just like the number one joke people tell me is like, right, time to make the donuts, right? Yeah, and I get that. I've heard that a million times, but there's a certain truth in it.
Do you ever just kick them in the shins?
Yeah, no,
you should.
Well, you know. I'm not trying to be arrested for assault and stuff.
Well, no, we don't want that.
Yeah.
I actually just want you to continue making great bread.
Thank you.
And
I will.
For your far-flung crazy interest in hobbies.
Do you want to talk about Bob Knight?
Yeah, let's end with Bob Knight.
Okay, here's the
Bob
thing.
Bob Knight is the one of the most accoladed basketball coaches in Indiana history and basketball history. He was then Texas Tech after that.
Yeah.
He also is a nightmare of a human.
Yep.
Bob, if you're listening, you are a nightmare of a human. Everybody knows that. Even you know that.
I'm fascinated by him. He's consumed with excellence, and he's also insane.
And consumed with rage.
And consumed with himself. Yeah.
And consumed with himself.
Yeah.
Is he one of the best basketball coaches ever?
Yes, has to be. Yes, absolutely. They're like,
how
so,
many championships has IU won under Bob Knight?
Four, right?
Really?
Three?
Wow.
Three? No, yeah, they have five stars.
Coach K.
Hey, Coach K played for Bob Knight. So, yeah, Coach K is a product of Army. And guess who was coaching in Army? Robert Montgomery Knight. Again, I'm not apologizing. Yeah.
You know his middle name. That's
of course.
So creepy.
Dude, I love Indiana. I love the state of Indiana, and I love basketball. And so, like, of course, like, but I have also, like, I do not like his politics. I don't like the way he treats human beings. I don't like the way, like, you know, he choked a kid.
He choked his own son.
No, it was a different player. No, he threw a chair. It's arguably the chair
came up a lot.
The chair, listen, you know what? He didn't hit anybody that I knew. Right. But he did choke a kid, and now you can't do that. And you can't talk to people the way he talks to people. But listen, and also his politics are trash. However, I admire his basketball mind.
Like you admired Gerard's baking skills.
Yes. People contain, you know,
There are multitudes of personalities within this world.
Absolutely.
Chris Wilkins, keep on baking good bread.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.